Good evening, everyone. Let's do a quick question and response here to begin the sermon. This is a question that might age a few of us, but it'll help me up. How many of you remember the old gaming system called the Nintendo 64? Let me see your hands. Nintendo 64, okay. How many of you have never heard of a Nintendo 64? Oh, man. Okay, so you're going to have to ask some questions of your parents. It looks like you kids around there. Okay, maybe I should describe a little bit how this gaming system worked. As was the case in the old days, feels weird for me to start saying that now. There was this block kind of gaming system, and you had like a cassette tape kind of thing, and you plugged it in the top of it, right? Am I right, parents? You know what Nintendo 64 is. Okay. So you put it into the top of the system. Now, ordinarily, did it work the first time? No, it did not. So there was always issues with these things, but they had some pretty awesome games. Let me ask another question. How many of you have heard of the game Mario Kart? Probably more of us. Okay. Well, that started on a Nintendo gaming system, and I played it a lot on Nintendo 64. Okay, so when it didn't work, what did you do? Well, if we're like reasonable, maybe we track down the audio cables and the video cables. Make sure the cables are plugged in right. Make sure the power's plugged in. Okay, if that was all set, what did you do? Yeah, you take out the game and you blow inside of it. You know, it's kind of funny to think about it now. We live in a digital era, but all that was physical copies of a game. Okay, you blow in the game, you put it back in, it still doesn't work. Then what do you do? You hit it. Yeah, so that's what we did to gaming systems once upon a time, kids, when they didn't work. And so I think back to that, I'm like, man, what a time to be alive. We fix things just by hitting them. And how interesting. And all that, just so we can play something like Mario Kart. Now, I bring up this story about a gaming system just to show how inefficient our activity was to actually get done what we wanted to get done, right? We wanted to play the game, and so we contrived all of these ways in order for us to actually be able to get the game to work. And so we might go through several rounds of this blowing and smacking just to get the game going. It's terribly inefficient. So our activity was not getting the intended response that we wanted to out of the gaming system. But when it did, it was a lot of fun, wasn't it, parents? Yes, it was. Don't tell your kids anything else because then it'll make you feel old. But here we are on Good Friday. And in order to lead us into our passage today, we're talking about responses. Those gaming systems were not very responsive. And we had to do all kinds of things to contrive them, to make them to fit into something that was effective for our uses. I wonder if somehow, sometimes, in some ways, not in the sense of smacking us around, but does God see us sometimes like those stubborn little Nintendo 64 games? You know, God is the ultimate creator of the universe. He's the ultimate creative one. He created all of life to be enjoyed and for us to bring him glory in everything that we do. And here we are, his creations, and we've been stubborn. And if not, listen to our creator who's caused us to live in this life, but then we don't live life according to his ways. We've been stubborn. We keep causing issues, don't we? And such as this was the case with those video games. But it is sometimes we do live rightly. Sometimes we do follow God by faith and obedience. But even then, we're quick to recognize, if we're honest with ourselves, that there's areas of our lives that still need some correction. Oftentimes, we're not right, but we're wrong towards God. And frequently, we need some correction ourselves. And so tonight, I want to invite you into some moments of reflecting on your own response to God. As I share the story about a stubborn video game, in what ways have you been stubborn toward the God who's created you? You know, God in his infinite kindness has revealed himself to us in his son Jesus. This Jesus then walked in obedience throughout all of his life, and then he walked a path that we're going to consider tonight. And it wasn't a path towards joy and happiness, at least right away, not the first time. It was a path toward his own death. And so that's what we're going to be considering tonight. And we'll be considering it from Luke chapter 23. So I invite you to turn there in your Bibles if you have one with you. The sermon this evening is going to be in Luke chapter 23, verses 26 through 43. If you would like to look on one of the hardback black Bibles around you, you can find it on page 884. If you don't have a Bible, please don't go home without one. We have bookshelves in the lobby. Feel free to take one on your way out. So join me as we focus in on this last few moments of Jesus' life, and how does Luke present them to us? So read with me, starting in verse 26. As they led him away, they seized one, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. And there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they cast lots to divide his garments. And the people stood by watching, and the rulers scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself. If he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was also an inscription over him, "This is the King of the Jews." And one of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And he said to Jesus, "Remember me," or he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." It's an amazing passage we have here. And I want us to continue to reflect on our response to the cross. What is your response to the cross? We're going to structure our time this evening by considering first the cross itself, and then we're going to consider from this passage four responses to the cross. So first, we're going to consider what the cross is and what happened there, and then we're going to consider how people responded to the cross. That's actually most of the narrative that we just read here, so we'll consider those responses as we move along. So first, let's consider the cross. As we have this next to me, we ordinarily have it on our stage. What happened there? What happened there? It's the whole reason why we gather here for a Good Friday service, is to remember what happened at the cross. So what happened there? Well, if we look down in this passage, you might find it interesting. This is Luke's crucifixion narrative of what happened to Jesus. And you might wonder, like, where are all the details? Now, you notice that there's relatively very few details, but we do get some. And here's some of the ones that we get. The cross itself is mentioned there in verse 26. So if you look down, you can see it. It's one of the first words that's mentioned in the narrative here. Then if you scroll down to, or if you scroll down in your... if you have a phone, maybe you'll scroll. With your eyes, you can scroll to verses 32 and 33. You get some more details about what the men did to Jesus at that point. And so if you see in verse 32, there's criminals there. And what it says is they were led away to be put to death with him. So what happened at the cross? The cross was the place of Jesus' death. And then you look down in verse 33, where Jesus is led along to a place called the Skull, and the text says there that they crucified him. The cross was the place of a brutal crucifixion of Jesus. And brothers and sisters, we do well to reflect on this cross. So the details in the text here are something we call terse. They don't have very many details, but the details that are given are significant. They don't go into all the bloody details, as we might describe them, but they are very intentional. So it's as if, you could think about it like this. Luke is saying, I'll give you a word because that's all that's necessary for you to understand. When he said the cross, there is evidently much more to be understood behind that word. When he says death or crucifixion, there's so much packed into those words that he doesn't go into more detail around it. For us today, you might think of it something like this. You ask a friend, what did the doctor say? And if the response is stage 4 cancer, they don't need to say anything else. In a similar kind of way, Luke is holding forth the cross. You see, before this passage, as we were led into this crucifixion narrative, Luke 22:63 mentions some of this crucifixion process. What happened to Jesus before these very moments? And it says that the crucifixion process involved in part beating of Jesus. He was lashed with whips and blindfolded, beaten to a brutal pulp. He was mocked, accused, spat upon, laughed at. He was humiliated. All of this was the Roman approach to torture. The people who were criminals were held out as public displays of their disdain. And so Jesus is receiving that very same kind of death, the same kind of treatment. This is a quote from a guy named Greg Gilbert. He describes death on a cross. It's very vivid. I'm just going to read this at length, but reflect on the words as I read it. It says, what was death on the cross like? Shredded flesh against unforgiving wood. Iron stakes pounded through the bone and racked nerves. Joints wrenched out of socket by the sheer dead weight of the body. Public humiliation before the eyes of family, friends, and the world. That was death on the cross. The infamous stake, as the Romans called it, the barren wood, the maxima mala crux, or as the Greeks spat it out, the stauros. Really, it's no wonder no one talked about it. It's no wonder parents hid their children's eyes from it. The stauros was a loathsome thing, and the one who died on it was loathsome too. The vile criminal whose only use was to hang there as a putrid, decaying warning to anyone who might follow his example. That is how Jesus died. So what happened on the cross? That. And as we read our narrative, that's where we're led to. Jesus is going there. It was brutal on this human level. And so, as Jesus endured these beatings, whippings, lashings upon his skin, we don't need to say much more. He was carrying his own torture device to his death. That's what our passage was all about. Now, friends, imagine, as this is all happening, that it's not just simply characters in a story that are looking on Jesus as this is happening. Imagine if that was you. You're the one looking at this happening to Jesus. How would you respond? I think that's likely what Luke has in mind here. When he's given us all of these different characters and the audience members that are all kind of around, you got these stories that the first audience might have heard, and they're reflecting on their own responses to these events that happened in Jesus' life, and Luke is holding them forward. They would have known the events that had taken place, and he holds forth these responses. So why shouldn't we consider our own? What's your response to the cross? So let's look at the four responses that we have here in this passage. Throughout the passage, Luke gives us four. And he's unique in this, by the way. So there's other gospels. Many of you will be familiar with this. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all have their own kind of crucifixion narrative. And Luke kind of has his own focus here. As I've mentioned before, he's sharing these different perspectives. He has different characters, at least. And there's more responses that he leans into here. So Luke does have an emphasis on these responses that he puts forward. He's also unique in this way, and we're going to see this as we move along, but Luke details Jesus's very heart toward those who are doing these things to him. Luke is very intentional to include how Jesus is presenting himself to them and his heart for them, even as he's experiencing these things. So here's the four responses: the surprised, the somber, the scoffing, and the saved. We're going to go through these in turn, but we start with the surprised. That's the first response we see, the surprised. We see this in verse 26. As Jesus is likely falling underneath the weight of this wooden beam, he's unable to hold it up by himself. He's being driven along by people who are telling him to bear the cross to the place where he's going to die. We get a name here. And the first name that we see is this guy named Simon of Cyrene. Now, it's very interesting, an interesting detail if you just kind of go through the passage and you're like, how come we get that guy's name? It's kind of interesting why they would put it in there. Evidently, Simon was a Gentile. The detail that we have in there is that he was from Cyrene, so he's likely outside of the Jewish community at the time. And we can only speculate as to why he was there, but we do know that he was there. You can imagine his surprise. It mentions he's from the country. So you've got this country boy coming into Jerusalem during all of these events, and before he knows it, he's grabbed and brought into the middle of the events themselves. Can you imagine the surprise that you might feel if that was you? Like, he just showed up, and then all of a sudden he finds himself in the middle of all of this. I think you would be surprised too. I would certainly be surprised. The other detail we get about him in the Bible is in the crucifixion narrative of Mark. So Mark 15:21 references Simon of Cyrene's children. And so his kids are evidently significant. Their names were Alexander and Rufus. Kids or youth out there, how would you like for your name to be Rufus? But that was one of his kids' names. The only other detail we get here from Luke is that he carried the cross behind Jesus. Of his own disciples, Jesus said earlier, Luke 9:23, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Now, we shouldn't get overly speculative about what's going on in the passage here, but I think it's likely that Simon was an early follower of Jesus. Now, we're not entirely sure when or where that might have happened, so it's possible that this event was his first consideration that he ever had of Jesus. So the first time he sees Jesus is this time when he's carrying his cross. That's possible. Or perhaps Jesus or Simon knew about the Passover and Jesus's ministry in some ways. So he knew that Jesus cared for the Gentiles and he goes out there and perhaps he had begun to believe. We can't really be sure about what happened, but someone like that would be very interested in what this Messiah person was going to have happen to him in Jerusalem at this time. And so I just want to consider, friend, maybe you're like Simon this morning. I can hardly see you out there because the lights are blinding to me, but perhaps you're surprised that you're here today. Maybe you had somebody invite you into church, or perhaps the first time you came into church, it was all kind of surprising to you too. Maybe you responded to a friend's invitation. You just showed up to check out what a church that meets in a movie theater is like. That's all kind of interesting. What's this all about? So if that's you, or if that was you in your lifetime, what's your response to Jesus? That's the biggest question that we can ask on a day like Good Friday. What's your response to this man? As you see the cross, what's your response to him? But in the midst of Simon's story, you should know that the call to all Christians, the call for following Jesus is open to anyone and everyone. Jesus says, if anyone would follow me, they must die so that they could truly live. And so the call to everyone, Jesus' call to everyone is to do just that, to take up your cross and to follow him. The life of a Christian is one of dying, but it's of dying of the things that are killing you. And Jesus is welcoming you into something that's truly life. So if you're wondering about what you should take away from this sermon, just hear that. Jesus invites you to lay down all of your perceived understandings of life, to submit them to him and allow him to control your life now. That's what the cross would mean for you. And what we would have you to do is say, if you would but believe that this Jesus was truly the Son of God, that he did live perfectly, that he actually did die on a cross, that he did resurrect from the dead, this kind of life, this new kind of life can be yours. Don't leave here today without considering that for yourself. Do you believe in Jesus? And if so, why not respond to him now? You might be surprised about what he would do. So that's one response. Another response is the somber one. We see this in verses 27 through 31, so you can just scan down there. We could also say these people are sad or they're solemn. You see this multitude of people. You see women mourning. They're lamenting for Jesus. And surely we can understand this. If Jesus is walking this path of brutality, it makes sense that someone surely would be emotionally affected by the events that are going on. And I think it's very interesting here, and I wanted to just note that Jesus was certainly a man as we know it today, a male. But that by no means suggests, and this text kind of brings that out, that Jesus knew anything less, and he had any less of a heart toward women. Jesus sees and knows your struggles. He knows your unique pains, your unique tears, your unique hopes for your own children, perhaps. And as Jesus is walking the path to the cross, I mentioned you see some of Jesus' heart. Part of what you see in Jesus' heart is his concern for the women who are watching him go on, and their concern for their children. And so if you've ever wondered if Jesus cares about you as a woman, let us be abundantly clear. Jesus cares about you even in the moments of his most brutal path to the cross. He's looking at you. He says, you are on his mind. But Jesus does more than comfort here. Most of his instruction as you go down recognizes the pain that women would be enduring. He's preparing them for what's going to happen. And it's primarily related to these women's children. Now, ordinarily in Jewish society, children were considered a blessing. But as he's quoting something from Hosea chapter 10 here, these women, they're feeling as if death would be better than life. And he's recognizing the reality of what these Jewish women are about to experience. He's referring to a time in the not-too-distant future from them when the destruction of Jerusalem was coming. In AD 70, brutal persecution would break out on them. You can look down in the text, verse 31, when Jesus says, "When these things happen, if these things happen when the wood is green, what will happen when he's dry?" Well, the green wood is Jesus. If these kinds of things are happening to Jesus, he turns it back on them and he says, what's going to happen when the wood is dry, when things are prepared, and there's more persecution coming in? He's preparing them for this, and in that way is showing them some compassion. He's preparing them for what is going to occur. It's recorded in history that something like over 1 million people were killed by the Romans during this period of time. So it makes sense that Jesus would prepare people for something like that. But what about our times? Don't we have suffering as well? Jesus gives a sobering word about life in this world to those who follow him. There's a constant refrain throughout the scriptures of the reality of suffering in this world. But there's also a reality of suffering for people who follow Jesus. And it's likely the case that some of these women were included in that. So Jesus gives us a sober warning. And it has its own element of surprise too. So I think it's appropriate for us to consider ways in our lives that we've struggled to grapple with suffering in our world, maybe in your own life. Maybe you're something like this. Jesus has asked you to follow him, right? To take up your cross daily and follow him. But maybe you're grappling with the reality that it's difficult even to connect with your neighbors. You might say that I want to know the classmates around me. I want to have genuine friends. I want to know the parents of the kids who go to school with my kids. I want them to know Jesus, but they're entirely disinterested. They're not interested in anything I have to say. In fact, I'm not even sure they want to be friends with me. It feels like I'm on an island. So in our world, that might be you. That's a unique kind of suffering that we feel today. Or you might be something like this. Following Jesus has caused me to have serious difficulty finding a spouse. Maybe you want to date someone, marry someone who knows and loves Jesus, but you're having a seriously difficult time doing that. It's a unique kind of suffering in our world. Or you might say, God, you love children. I have some of my own and I love them. Not me, I'm talking about you. But God, they demand so much of me. How much more can I sacrifice for them? Maybe you're feeling that. I'm losing focus at my job. I'm losing money in the bank. And for all things good and holy, I'm losing sleep too. Maybe that's a suffering that you're feeling today. Or maybe you're looking at Jesus and you're like, Jesus, I know that your heart is to reach the nations by making disciples, and that comes through church planting. Praise God. And here I am at a church plant, wouldn't you know it, in an area that really needs one, but I still have this job, I still have these kids, and now in this church I have difficult people all around me, and I'm one of them, by the way. So the surprise of following Jesus can hit all of us, in unique ways, but let me put it like this for you. Jesus is not calling us to walk a path that he himself has not walked. Or even better, Jesus is not calling you to walk a path that he himself will not empower you to walk right now. In the midst of your suffering, you can know that God, as you believe in him, is with you in the midst of your suffering. Hebrews calls this our discipline in this life. Hebrews 12:3 says, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Like, how easy is it to grow weary and faint-hearted in this life? If we're honest, it's so easy to fall there. But Hebrews 12:11 says, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Jesus himself endured hostility, but by God's power, he has promised to those who have faith in him that he will bear you up in the midst of it. So hear God's promise to you. Your present pain is preparing you for a future fruit of peace and righteousness. That's what all of our suffering in this life looks like as we look to Jesus at the cross. That's a message for those who are somber considering the cross. Now let's consider the third response, the scoffing. So we've had the surprised, we have the somber, now we have the scoffing. You can look down there, we see it in verses 32 through 39. The scoffing comes from people like religious leaders, like soldiers, like one of the criminals. And you see here the religious leaders, they're scoffing at him. The soldiers, they're mocking him. One of the criminals, even as he's dying on the cross, it says rails at him. So the scoffing is unmistakable. So it's clear. We can see Jesus is sneered at. He's taunted. He's made fun of. People are yelling at him. And the text is very interesting here. When it leads into the section on Jesus's scoffing, it mentions these two criminals. Right, he's going there with two criminals. It's intentional to mention there's one on his right and one on his left. What's going on there? Well, in some sense, there's some fulfillment of prophecy going on here, and it happens all throughout this passage. But Isaiah 53:12 says that the Messiah of God would be numbered with the transgressors. Jesus is being numbered with the transgressors here. And it's significant to notice what Jesus' response was to those who mocked him. Look down at verse 34. Like, how amazing of the Son of God in the midst of his own suffering, what he would tell the people who were doing this to him. And it's very powerful. Verse 34, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Can you imagine what tender mercy someone would have to have going through the brutal treatment of the cross and to say something like that? I just think about myself. Like, how quick am I to have anything near that kind of reaction? Like, I think about a pickup basketball game, and someone starts taunting me on a basketball court. Like, I am not inclined to be very gracious to them. In fact, I want to stomp them in the ground more often than not, and I want to make sure that I respond in like kind to them. Maybe I'm not the only person here. I'm just confessing sin in front of you. But maybe you can recognize this. Like, how powerful is it of Jesus in the very moment where he would have been right to invoke his own righteousness and to call down judgment on them. Instead of doing that, he calls for their forgiveness. Did you know that about Jesus? Did you know that about his heart? Even among those who scoff at him, who mock him, he wants them to be forgiven. Now then the question arises, what do we do with a verse like this? Does Jesus actually grant forgiveness there from the cross? I don't think I would say that. I don't think Jesus is actually granting forgiveness here, because you notice he's praying a prayer, right? He's praying to his Father, and he's asking for the Father to forgive them. Now, surely these men were acting in some degree of ignorance. They didn't fully grasp everything that they were doing, but that doesn't excuse them from the evil that they were doing, and such is the case with us. We can't make excuses for the evil that we do. We're still ultimately guilty of those things, but that does not mean that forgiveness cannot come to even someone like that if they would turn away from their wickedness and trust in God. Jesus gives hope for the very worst of us, those who scoff at him. Let's skip down and look at the last response. The scoffers. Now let's look at the saved. The saved. We see it here with this last thief on the cross, as he's commonly mentioned, or here he's just called a criminal. Starting in verse 30, this man, he hears the mocking voices of the people around him, and he rebukes the guys who are rebuking Jesus. He says, "Do you not fear God?" He's questioning, "Do you seriously have no gravitas about who this God is? Since you're under the same sentence of condemnation, you deserve death just like me." And this criminal, he looks at the other criminal, he says, "We indeed justly, for we've received the due reward for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." He just looks at Jesus and he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And it's amazing Jesus' response, isn't it? "Truly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." Notice this man. He speaks up for Jesus. He recognizes his guilt and the judgment that he rightly deserves. He recognizes also Jesus' innocence. And then he asks that Jesus would remember him. And then Jesus gives him this ultimate promise that he would be with him in paradise. In fact, he says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." What assurance. If you've ever wondered what it means to be saved by Jesus, this man in his very last moments had the opportunity to do so. He recognized his own guilt. He did not deserve God's grace, but yet he pled with Jesus that he would be forgiven, and Jesus offers that forgiveness. Why don't you allow that to be your story today? As we continue our service, we're going to read a song. We're going to sing a song. And as you consider your own response to Jesus, I want you to think about these words as they're sung. It says, "Behold the man upon the cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice calling out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life, and I know that it is finished." Why don't you let that be your prayer this evening? Let's pray. Lord, I pray that as we consider the cross this evening, as we consider our own response, that it would indeed be this one of the saved. We would recognize our guilt, our need for you, and the work that you've done there. Lord, I ask that you would help us to reflect upon this moment as we continue to worship. In Jesus' name, amen.